Hello and welcome to the Center for Thomas More Studies. This is Dr. Veronica Brooks, the Education Director for the Center. Today we're going to be doing a brief introduction to the text of Thomas More's Utopia. If you want to read along with me today, you'll find the text of Utopia starting on page 145 of the Essential Works of Thomas More. So why don't we begin there with a brief discussion of the title of the text. If you look on page 144, you'll notice, looking at the full Latin title of the text, that it's much longer than the common title that's used, Utopia. It's actually called On the Best State of a Commonwealth and On the New Island of Utopia, a truly golden handbook no less beneficial than entertaining by the most distinguished and eloquent author, Thomas More, citizen and undersheriff of the famous city of London. So More's major concern in this text is with a question that goes back to Plato, Aristotle, and other classical philosophers, which is to say, what is the best constitution, the best type of regime? And if you'll notice, this theme of the best regime is actually separated from Utopia itself. This is a book on the best state of a commonwealth and on the new island of Utopia. So More doesn't say that Utopia is necessarily the best commonwealth. There's a bit of ambiguity in the title that invites some critical thinking about the institutions that we are going to be presented with in the island of Utopia. If you turn to page 152 of your text and take a look at note number 3, you'll notice that the word Utopia derives from the Greek word topos, which means place, and also the prefix u, which could either mean not, or it could mean happy. So Utopia, as a title, could either point us in the direction of a happy place, but it may also exist no place. So once again, there's ambiguity in the title, inviting the reader to consider both the possibility and the desirability of the institutions that we're going to see on the island. This text is a recording of a conversation between Thomas More, Peter Giles, and one Raphael Hithloday. And just as there's ambiguity in the name of the island Utopia, there's also ambiguity and irony in the name of Raphael Hithloday. If you take a look at note 5 on page 162, you'll notice that while Raphael's first name indicates his role as a kind of divine guide or a divine healer, his surname, Hithloday, comes from the Greek words for peddler of nonsense. Another invitation to critical thinking about what exactly Raphael is going to ask us to believe about his adventures in the island of Utopia. Now we're going to devote most of our attention today to Raphael's account of Utopia in Book 2, but if you haven't already done so, I encourage you to check out on the same webpage the very good introduction to Book 1 given by Dr. Stephen Smith. There you'll find a very thorough reflection on Book 1. For now, we're just going to focus on page 173 of the Essential Works. And it's here that Raphael points to the institution of private property itself as the root cause of this severe economic inequality that leads to the problem of theft. And he makes the claim that a good regime is defined as one that excludes private property. Private property produces wealth disparity, which leads to oligarchy. And so Raphael's radical solution is the abolition of private property. And he will later say that this is the one and only path to justice. Now he admits on page 173, right around line 63, that certain laws, for example, laws forbidding or regulating monopolies, laws forbidding or mitigating enclosure, that practice, These types of laws can mitigate the abuse of private property that leads to the kind of injustice that he has been condemning. But mitigation of the problem is not enough for Raphael. Raphael insists on total elimination of human misery. About line 75, he says, "Such laws, I say, could mitigate and alleviate these ills, just as applying continual poultices can relieve the symptoms of sick bodies that are beyond healing. But as long as everyone has his own property, there is no hope whatever of curing them and putting society back into good condition." So Raphael's standard of success is no less than a complete cure of political ills. And this is the standard that animates his endorsement of the institutions of utopia, which he will go on to describe in great detail in Book 2. So this discussion provides the backdrop for Book 2 of Utopia, in which this political problem, this problem of severe wealth disparity, economic imbalance, or poverty or necessity, is supposedly remedied on the island of Utopia. So turning to Book 2 and speaking generally about the island of Utopia, what we immediately notice about Utopia are three basically good things that the Utopians have achieved. The first of those things is plenty. And this plenty is achieved in spite of the fact that all property is shared equally. So that the closing discussion of Book 1, when Raphael declares that the abolition of private property is the only path to justice, the character of Thomas Morris is going to object that if everything is shared equally, people are going to stop working and there will not be an abundance of everything. There will be scarcity as a result. But according to Raphael, the Utopians have solved this conundrum. In Utopia, everything is equalized, and yet everyone has plenty of everything. Food, clothing, shelter, jobs for all. Necessities are taken care of by a centrally planned communist economy, and therefore there's no need for the rampant theft of the nature that we see in England. Raphael says as much on page 182, right around line 40-41. He discusses that all commodities are kept in a marketplace, and the products of each household are taken to designated houses there, and each kind of goods is separately stored in a warehouse. From them, each head of the household goes to get whatever he and his household need, and he takes away whatever he wants, paying no money and giving absolutely nothing in exchange for it. For why should he be denied anything, since there is plenty of everything and no one need fear that anyone would want to ask for more than he needs? For why should anyone be suspected of asking for too much if he is certain he will never lack for anything? Moreover, this remarkable abundance is achieved without overworking anyone. The Utopians have leisure. We are told they only actually work for 6 hours a day. So if you look back on page 179, right around line 60, Raphael tells us, "Dividing the day and night into 24 equal hours, they devote only 6 to work, 3 before noon when they go to lunch, and after lunch they take 2 hours of rest in the afternoon, then 3 more given over to work, after which they have dinner. The intervals between work, meals, and sleep they are allowed to spend however they like, provided that the time they have free from work is not wasted in debauchery and idleness, but spent well in some other pursuit according to their preference." And he goes on to explain that many choose to use their free time in pursuit of a kind of contemplative life, a life of study, which Moore and the humanists themselves very much admired. So the Utopians have all their material necessities provided for them, but they also are provided with the leisure to pursue a life of wisdom and contemplation. And this brings us to the third excellent quality of Utopia, which is that The governing principle of utopia appears to be wisdom. Now, the classical political philosophers who Moore would have read tended to assess different constitutions or regime types by looking at the justice or injustice of their governing principle or their ruling premise. Now, this premise or governing principle is most clearly seen in how they answer the question of who gets to rule. What qualities entitle one person or a few or many people to rule over the others? In other words, what qualities do they honor the most? Now, the classical answer is that wisdom is the best quality in a ruler. But also, the rule of wisdom has to be combined with the consent of those who are governed as a practical matter. This is the problem present in Plato's Republic. So all rulers, regardless of their qualifications, depend, practically speaking, on the obedience of those they serve. Utopia seems to achieve this balance in which the rulers are trained to be wise men, and they are also only able to rule with the consent of the governed. So while everyone works in utopia, and this is part of what allows them to achieve their abundance of material goods, the one exception to this rule is the class of scholars. There's a scholarly class who are exempted from work so that they have leisure to study and grow in wisdom, and they spend their lives in pursuit of this wisdom. So it's a class of wise men, and it's from this class that all of the rulers are selected. So like England, Utopia has a ruling class. But unlike England, the ruling class is not hereditary based on blood or family, but based on merit, and merit is defined as wisdom. Now, as a rule, anyone can join the scholarly class provided they have an aptitude for study. So the officials known as the syphogrants are tasked with selecting those who demonstrate an aptitude for learning and appointing them to the class of scholars. Now, it's important, however, that these syphogrants who appoint the scholars and who in turn elect every official in Utopia, every political governing official is elected by the syphogrants. The syphogrants themselves are elected directly by the people. Now, we're told that there is one syphogrant representing 30 households in Utopia. So effectively what this means is that Utopia is a popular sovereignty. While there's a governing class of wise men, at the same time, it's ultimately the citizens of Utopia who are the root of authority. And this is in keeping with many of the epigrams that Moore published along with the 1518 edition of Utopia, which argue that political authority is conferred by the consent of the people. So in Utopia, that consent is secured by the office of the syphogrants, who once again will in turn elect all other governing officials. So one way or another, all offices in Utopia are elected either directly or indirectly by the citizens of Utopia. And perhaps it's thanks to this elective structure that we are told later, about page 197, that leaders in Utopia are obeyed willingly and not out of fear or constrained obedience. And this is an important political principle for the humanists in general. We see this principle of willing obedience being normative, reflected again in Thomas More's epigrams, but also in The Education of a Christian Prince by More's good friend Erasmus, which is published the same year as Utopia. Leaders must be loved by the people and willingly obeyed by them. Constrained or forced obedience amounts to slavery. So the humanist understanding of liberty hinges on this willing obedience to rulers who are perceived by the people to be virtuous and rule for their good. Raphael tells us, "The Utopians live together amiably, since no magistrate is arrogant or terrifying. They are called fathers, and they live up to the name. Honor is willingly paid to them, as is proper. It is not exacted from those unwilling to give it. So, stepping back and reflecting, what would more the humanist want his readers to admire in the Constitution of Utopia? First of all, that primary need for physical material goods is met for everyone. And over and above that, citizens have free time or liberty to pursue sort of higher, more leisurely activities such as contemplation. And finally, the ruling principle of utopia is wisdom. It's wise men who rule, but they do so with the consent of the governed. So, what makes it all possible? How is it that this excellent structure is achieved in utopia? Is it because of or in spite of the communal sharing of goods and labor? Because if you recall the conversation at the end of book one, Raphael says this equal sharing of things, this abolition of private property is essential to a just regime, whereas Morris objects that when everything is shared, everyone will stop working because human beings tend to be motivated by profit. So is this abundance and this structure of liberty, is it all achieved because of or in spite of the communal sharing in utopia? Now, Raphael gets a bit defensive about the structure about on page 180, around line 25. He says, at this point, it is necessary to examine the matter in more detail to avoid making a mistake. If only 6 hours are devoted to work, you might think that there would necessarily be some shortage of supplies. Which again recalls the character Moore's objection at the end of book one. So what does make it possible? According to Raphael, the utopians have achieved this extraordinary goal of eliminating idleness. There are no idle classes as there are in England, Raphael says on page 180. Moreover, there are no unnecessary trades. So the utopians work efficiently because they have eliminated luxury or unnecessary or unnatural pleasures. So the utopian abundance relies on this philosophy of pleasure, which Raphael will describe in detail, beginning on page 187 and 188. Now, this is a kind of odd discussion because, bearing in mind some of Moore's classical sources that he would have had in mind influencing this discussion, it emerges that the utopians are not entirely consistent in their views of pleasure. They say they only permit good and natural pleasures, like the pleasure of doing good deeds or the pleasure of music, as opposed to artificial and immoral pleasures like hunting and gambling. But this is an odd distinction because the utopians, as it turns out, really like their pleasures. Raphael tells us on page 184, about line 30, that they tend to incline to the position that no kind of pleasure ought to be forbidden as long as no harm comes of it. On the other hand, on page 188, on line 40, Raphael says they seem a bit over-inclined to the position which claims that all or the most important part of human happiness consists of pleasure. So they seem over-inclined to value pleasure, so much so that a state religion is required to force obedience to law and other forms of ethical behavior. Around line 66, Raphael says, if this religion was eliminated, the utopians have no hesitation in affirming that no one could be so stupid as not to feel that he ought to pursue his own pleasure by hook or by crook. But if the standard of nature is enough to keep pleasure within its proper bounds, why is theology required? And why is anyone who questions that theology considered less than human and even denied the privileges of citizenship? So there's something a bit inconsistent in their account of human happiness. It turns out if we look very closely at utopian opinions and institutions, they may have a somewhat unrealistic view of human nature. One example of this would be in the loss or diminution of certain liberties that most human beings are accustomed to. One of these being the liberty to travel from place to place or from city to city. On page 184, Raphael says traveling is easy, but in practice, there are actually many reasons for being denied permission to travel. And even when permission is granted, there are certain requirements that have to be met. You have to travel with a group. You need a letter from the governor or the princeps of the city. Your time of stay will be limited, and if it's more than one day, you're going to have to work. And this requirement of getting permission to travel includes going on a walk within the borders of one's own city. And the utopians take these requirements so seriously that violations are punished with slavery. And this is because it seems that in order to make the utopian structure work, the citizens have a need for constant supervision by the cyphogrants. On page 179, around line 50, we are told that the chief and practically the only function of the cyphogrants is to take care and see to it that no one lounges around in idleness, but rather that everyone practices his trade diligently. So how to guarantee that everyone has plenty of everything while everything is shared equally? Constant supervision and restriction of liberty of movement is a first step. And this is why, at the same time, all privacy seems to have been eliminated from utopia. They eat their meals in public. And even conversation at mealtime is supervised by the elders. There are no locking doors on any of the homes. And the homes themselves are changed by lot every 10 years. So it turns out in utopia that citizens are not really free to go where they want or even to live where they want. And this is a necessary consequence of their system of sharing everything equally. On page 176, Raphael mentions that they know exactly how much produce is consumed by each city. And it turns out that they know this only because they keep strict quotas on their population. They don't regulate birth, as in some of the classical sources. But what do? If you look at line 84, to keep the city from being either over or underpopulated, they see to it that no household has fewer than 10 or more than 16 adults, for it is not possible to set a limit for children. This limit is easily maintained by transferring persons from households with too many to those with too few. But if it should happen that the whole city grows too large, they use the excess to supply underpopulated cities. But if it should happen that throughout the island the whole mass of the population should swell inordinately, they sign up citizens from each city and send them as colonists to live under their own laws on the nearest part of the continent. But of course, in order to make this colonial policy work, we're told in a moment that the utopians are forced at times to drive out the natives. So what this means is that in order for the utopian system to work, the utopians are forced to engage in wars of conquest. And this is significant because both Moore and his friend Erasmus often denounced wars of conquest. And we see one of these denunciations in Book One of Utopia, where this is one of the causes of poverty and rampant theft in England. So this is an instance in which Raphael, after correctly diagnosing a problem in the English regime, appears to have a nice solution, but it turns out the problem creeps back in through the back door. Both More and Erasmus were keenly aware of the tendency of kings to desire to acquire more territory and engage in these types of wars. And so we frequently see More, Erasmus, and other northern humanists denouncing war as such, particularly unnecessary war, by which they mean these wars of conquest. And this is what gives a kind of irony to the section in Utopia on their military tactics, which can be found beginning on page 199 of the Essential Works. Now here we're told that the Utopians loathe war as positively bestial, and that they avoid it at all costs. But then it turns out that they tend to go to war a lot. As we've seen, their communist structure necessitates wars of conquest as a systemic consequence. In addition to this fact, the Utopians' list of reasons for going to war, for just war, is rather long. And then we are told about a war in that part of the world of catastrophic proportions, and Raphael suggests that the cause may or may not have been just. So there's a pattern that can be seen in this section on utopian warfare, in which what the utopians say about war, or what Raphael says of the utopians, does not always match with the deeds and actions that we're presented with. On the one hand, they loathe war and are reluctant to engage in it, but they tend to wage it often. We are also told that they hate bloodshed, and as a substitute for this kind of force, they will use skill and cunning. And this is considered to be more humane. But what kinds of things do they mean by cunning? Well, it turns out the utopian tactics resemble quite a bit the tactics of the European monarchs that Raphael himself condemned in Book One. The utopians will employ the Zapolite mercenaries. This is a kind of barbaric race of people. And we are told that the utopians have no qualms about doing away with many of them because they believe the human race would owe them a great debt of gratitude if they could purge the whole world of such loathsome and wicked scum. So the utopians' humanity includes a kind of shameless endorsement of genocide. So we've gone over a few issues in Utopia, some which seem at face value to be generally excellent features of Utopia, some which at face value seem to be things that more the author would have questioned. This is not an exhaustive treatment of these issues and ambiguities. For a complete list of things that are good in Utopia, as well as things that seem either inconsistent, implausible, or absurd, you'll want to check out the study guide available at thomasmorestudies.org under the heading of Teaching Materials on Utopia. And this is a valuable tool because the consideration of these things is exactly what More invites us to consider in the concluding dialogue of Book Two. Now, Book Two of Utopia ends when Raphael declares that Utopia is the only regime that deserves to be called a commonwealth. By abolishing the use of money and private property, the Utopians have eliminated a whole host of political evils from human life, or their way of life. And this way of life is so excellent, Raphael says on page 210, that he has no doubt that the rest of the world would adopt these institutions were it not for one obstacle. And that is the reality of pride. This is page 210, about line 75. Raphael says, "Pride measures prosperity not by her own advantages, but by the disadvantages of others. She would not even wish to be a goddess unless there were some wretches left whom she could order about and lord it over, whose misery would make her happiness seem all the more extraordinary, whose poverty can be tormented and exacerbated by a display of her wealth. This infernal serpent pervading the human heart keeps men from reforming their lives, holding them back like a suckfish. Since pride is too firmly fixed in the minds of men to be easily plucked out, I am glad that this form of commonwealth, which I would gladly see adopted by everyone, is at least enjoyed by the utopians. And they are so happy, Raphael says, that their institutions are likely to last forever. But once again, there is an irony at play in this passage, because what Raphael declares to be true about pride, which is that it's not easily eradicated from the human heart, and also that it's the cause of the desire for superiority over others, actually contradicts his premise that the abolition of money and property would solve the problems which he then attributes to pride. But Raphael says this vice has no place in the utopian scheme of things. Interesting claim to ponder. And on the final page, we're left with the character Thomas More's final judgment that not a few institutions in Utopia are rather absurd. And these absurdities include the utopians' military tactics, their religion, and finally the principal foundation of their whole social structure, namely their common life and subsistence with no exchange of money. Finally, after observing these absurdities, More's final comments are on page 211, line 43. I readily confess that in the Utopian Commonwealth are very many features which, in our societies, I would wish rather than expect to see. So there's something wishful about Utopia. And we're invited to consider what exactly that means. There are things in Utopia that are certainly desirable, but their possibility is called into question here. Perhaps they don't take certain elements of human nature into account, or even certain practical obstacles that might be proper to particular political communities. But keeping the spirit of Book One in mind, I don't think the ending of Utopia is meant to be pessimistic. Perhaps this concluding dialogue simply points to the need for prudence in political reforms. If you cannot make something good, at least make it as little bad as you can. But even the project of making something as little bad as one can requires a knowledge of true principles. And it may be that More means to provide these principles in Utopia. But in order to discern what they are, an act of judgment is required. Sifting through the various institutions that are presented in Utopia, trying to figure out what is absurd, what is possible, what is desirable, what is not desirable. More recommends this very act of judgment in his second letter to Peter Giles, beginning on page 214. More writes to his friend that he's delighted by the judgment of a certain critical but friendly reader who has found some absurdities in the book. More says on page 215, I do not know whether any other critique since the book came out has pleased me as much as this one. For first of all, motivated either by his regard for me or for the work itself, it seems that he did not begrudge the effort of reading it all the way through, and that not cursorily and hastily the way priests read the divine office, but deliberately and carefully so as to weigh the details thoughtfully. More goes on to tease this friend by making a critique of his own. As if there were no absurdities elsewhere in the world, or as if any of all the philosophers everywhere had so devised a commonwealth, a ruler, or a household so perfectly as to propound nothing that could not be improved. The key to the story may be contained in this little remark of More's. Political life may contain perennial, inescapable absurdities, but there's always hope for improvement. Thanks for listening.